Blog Talk Radio.
We own this country. We own it. And it's not you owning it and not politicians owning it. Politicians are employees of ours. And they're just going to come around and beg for votes every few years, and it's the same old deal. But I just think that it's important that you realize that whether you're Democrat or whether you're a Republican or whether you're Libertarian or whatever, when somebody does not do the job, we got to let them go.
When your entire culture is under attack, you need the country's number one voice in defense of our American way of life. You need an ally in the fight against tyranny and corruption. You need your weekly dose of Lisa Payne Nager. Missouri Grassroots Radio Network proudly adds our own beauty to America the Beautiful, your own culture vigilante, Ms. Lisa Payne Nager.
Good evening. It's Wednesday evening, 7 o'clock Midwestern time. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and this is your Culture Vigilante Hour on Missouri Grassroots Radio. We're thrilled to be with you again this evening. Time has just flown by in the last week. Can't believe it's been a week since we've been here, but it's, I guess that kind of happens to you when you get older. Time flies by and you move slower. Time moves fast, you move slower. I don't know how that works, but it's kind of working for me this week. Anyway, we're here again. Happy to be with you. We are in the middle of another legislative, we're in the midst, hot and heavy, of another legislative session here in Missouri. And we've been watching the legislation, and there's a lot of stuff going on. And we'll talk a little bit about that, or a lot about that tonight, as we'll have Tom Mark on with us later of the Locke and Smith Foundation. He's going to help us with, we've got a Yankee Doodle legislation alert, or actually several Yankee Doodle legislation alerts to talk about, and we'll probably have a nice little heated debate about right to work as well. Tom and I may be on opposite ends of the right to work issue. He may be looking at this from a different perspective than I am, and we'll find out what his perspective is. And a couple of weeks ago, tried to have Bill Federer on the program. Bill Federer has been on several times before with us. We love having him on. Great historian. Nobody knows more about the real facts of American history than Bill Federer. Anyway, had a little mix-up a couple weeks ago. Got him back on tonight. He's got a new book to talk about and a few other things, so we'll be talking to him. And we're thrilled to death. One of the most important things in America now, and that has just crept up on Americans because we've been unaware, we haven't been watching, is Agenda 21, and it's in every aspect of our government, on every level of our government, from the local municipalities all the way to the federal government. It's in our education system. It's in our local county councils. It's in our planning and zoning. It's just in everywhere. So we have Ray Cuneo on. He's been on with us several times before, and he's back with us tonight to kind of give us a perspective of just how Agenda 21 looks inside your local community, and how some local non-government organizations are leading by the nose your county councils and your municipal governments to put things into place that are Agenda 21 driven. So he'll be on with us a little bit later tonight. Very happy to have with us sitting in again this evening, Cindy McGee. Cindy McGee of Show Me Patriots is here. She's going to sit in and talk to us about various issues tonight. Just thrilled to death to have her back after a long absence. Cindy, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here. I've been looking forward to this.
Well, good. And we're looking forward to you starting your own show here on Missouri Grassroots Radio on Tuesday evenings at 7 o'clock. We're in the preparation stages of that and hope to get that fired up soon. You're going to call it Show Me Patriots.
Yeah, I think that I am. I think that that's pretty much the clarion call right now. Show Me Patriots. We need patriots to be aligning and getting in the fight. So I think it's an appropriate name for the show.
And Show Me Patriots is the name of a grassroots organization that you head up. It's very popular here in the east central part of the state of Missouri. You've been very active in the past in making people aware of issues and working to put on events and to engage the folks. What have you done in the past, Cindy?
Well, we really focused on educating people and getting them activated. In other words, getting them participating in the system in a variety of ways. And in the past, I've helped, I helped with Prop C from the very inception and idea. You know, I was there when the idea was born, and we were one of the groups that really helped push that through the state legislature. Of course, that we had a very disappointing outcome with that, but we worked really hard on that. And that's when we started to really get a pretty good idea of what it means when you end up with the Yankee Doodle legislation.
Exactly.
So, it was an honest effort on the part of the Patriots and not such an honest effort on the part of some of our legislators. So, but nonetheless, we did get the job done. And, and we've helped to educate people on a variety of issues. We kept people posted on what was going on in Washington, D.C., and put out legislative alerts when things were popping that needed addressing, and made it easy for people to call their legislators, to email their legislators, and to have that interaction. So that's just some of the stuff, and I've
It's a lot of hard work, folks. When you are in the middle of a grassroots organization and you're trying to educate the populace, not only are you trying to get people involved who are not normally involved in a situation, or normally involved in government on a state level, you're trying to educate them about what's really going on. And then you're also, as we've come to find out and come to learn, you have to unspin the spin coming out of the state capitol. And there's a lot of that goes on. And you have to try to get the truth out so that people can understand it. And sometimes it's very convoluted and very twisted and spun into just all kinds of yarns. And I mean, when you are running a grassroots organization, one of the biggest things and the biggest challenges that you have as a grassroots leader is trying to get people to stay grounded and not to idolize and worship your elected, to where you can coherently and cognitively disassemble the spin that kind of comes from them and try to find out what the agendas are and debunk some of that stuff coming out of the Capitol. Have you had that problem in the past, Cindy?
Absolutely. In fact, I was just going to say, you really hit the nail on the head, and that's a lesson that we learned the hard way. And, early we made the mistake of being a little too free with our microphones at some of our meetings with some of the legislators, and in hindsight, that probably wasn't the right thing to do. Certainly, we have to have a respectful attitude towards the offices that they hold. But that so often we have a hard time discerning between being respectful to the office and idolizing and worshiping these people. They put their pants on one leg at a time. They are just like us, and they've been elected. They chose to run. They chose to this life of public servant, and that's exactly what they are. They work for us, and we need to remind them of that sometimes, because they tend to get pretty puffed up in what they're doing and forget what's really going on back at home.
Yeah, don't you find, if you look back at the history of the Tea Party movement, from 2009 when it really started to explode and everybody was having Tea Party gatherings and rallies everywhere. I mean, we're in St. Louis, so, we were in the hotbed of the Tea Party movement era here, and we had some great, really great events. And at first, they were fabulous. I mean, we had, you had patriots up there speaking and local people that were involved in situations and had expertise in the area were the main speakers and the driving force of the patriot movement. And you didn't have elected officials. You would see them circulating in the crowd, which was good. That's exactly where they needed to be. They didn't need the platform on the stage. They should have been in the crowd rubbing elbows with the folks. And that's really, I think, when the Tea Party movement was the strongest, and we lost a lot of credibility and a lot of steam when we started to allow these elected officials time on the stage and behind a microphone. We gave them our captive audience. And, with as much as I hate to say this, and I'm probably going to make a lot of people mad out there, but, there are just a lot of people, even in the Patriot movement, who are really looking to be followers, and they don't really think they're looking to be led, and they want, and it didn't take too long for a lot of these elected to start speaking patriot, You know, they figured out what the speak was that held people captive. I mean, and that's the basis for Yankee Doodle legislation. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But they understood the language, and they picked it up and put it into their vernacular. And a lot of people have made heroes out of some of these elected because they're so good at speaking the constitutional speak.
That's right. And, you know, we really did see that happen. And it's amazing. One of the gifts that politicians have is being able to pick up on the jargon that's going to push the right buttons, and they manipulate people with that. And I hate to sound so cynical, but it's sometimes the truth hurts, but the truth is still the truth, and that is what happens. And, you know, it's difficult sometimes for us to discern between sincerity and just people who are just speaking our language because they know that they can move us in a certain direction by doing that.
Yeah, and it's just really, really hurt the Patriot movement, I think, to be able to, I mean, we've just kind of lost our focus in our direction.
It really has, and I see that a lot. I see that so much in Missouri and some of the states where I see a lot of success with the Patriot groups and the Tea Party, whatever we want to call it. It's all of that. You know, I dare say that we would find that they had not made the mistake of integrating their politicians with the message that they were trying to get out. Certainly there's got to be communication there, but the politicians don't need our microphones. They have a big enough microphone.
Right. They can speak to you just as well on the House or the Senate floor by how they vote.
That's exactly right. And, you know, and what they need to be doing is hearing what the people are saying, and they need to be weighing that in the balance and weighing that against what they're planning to do in the halls of the legislature.
Right.
That's their job. And our job is to get that message out there. And, you know, for too long we've not done that. We've all taken our lumps over the last 4 years for our lack of engagement and not being there. And we certainly had legislators throwing that at us, and justifiably so. Those days are behind us. We're engaged. We're here. We're here to stay. And they need to get used to us. And I think they're having a little – sometimes I think they have a little difficulty knowing how to relate to us. We get talk to a lot about how we're supposed to relate to them and how we're not supposed to offend them and how we need to act when we're at the state capitol and when we address them and what we can and can't do. And, you know, maybe it's time to have a legislative day where the legislators come and learn how to speak to the public and to treat the public and the people that they serve.
That's right, because that's true. They're our servants. So,
right.
I don't know if you heard this. I have an audio clip today that it's been on the radio, and it's been all over the blogs for the last several days. There's a voter fraud thing that there's a gal, I think, in Ohio that a news station in Ohio interviewed this gal. She admitted on television, now it's national, of course, that she went and voted several times for Barack Obama. And voted for her sister and her cousin and everybody else. So I just found it very ironic when we had an election here and we're all facing the consequences of the last election. And I've always wondered about the outcome. I just never felt comfortable that this was a clean fought won election. I always thought there was dirty tricks at play, and people are always talking about voter fraud. I mean, when you think of how close it is, I mean, it's, you know, pretty 50-50 split. And when we have people like this working so hard for the other side, it kind of makes you wonder. So I want to play this clip for you.
There's absolutely no intent on my part to commit any voter fraud.
That's what a surprised Meloise Richardson told me Wednesday outside her Madisonville home. However, those words were quickly followed by these.
Yes, I voted twice.
Richardson said she mailed in an absentee ballot but feared it would arrive too late to be counted.
I, after registering thousands of people, certainly wanted my vote to count, so I voted. I voted at the poll.
Then there's the finding that Richardson's granddaughter, India, a first-time voter, cast two ballots and that Richardson sent in one of them.
I absolutely voted an absentee ballot for her. I did let her know that I was getting an absentee ballot for her and sending it in. I had to get her Social Security number for that. But I assume she forgot or was just excited, and she went to the polls herself.
Another claim is absentee ballots for Montez Richardson, Joseph Jones, and Marcus Barron all came from Richardson's Wetzel Avenue address, were received by the board the same time as Richardson's, and the handwriting on all four of them was similar.
Marcus Barron lives here. Joseph Jones is my brother. He's here from time to time. I am Montez's power of attorney. I voted for her in her absence.
So were these all legal votes in your mind?
Absolutely legal votes. Absolutely.
This case of Meloise Richardson is far from over.
So you'll fight this?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I'll fight him. For Mr. Obama and for Mr. Obama's right to sit as President of the United States.
Can you believe that? I mean, can you believe that?
That's pretty stunning. It's really stunning.
Have you heard that before?
I had not heard that, actually. I missed that one. I had heard about it, but I had not actually heard the clip. And the, you know, that says a lot about our culture, Lisa, and why we're in so much trouble.
Well,
that people think that it is okay to cheat, to get what they want, and that it goes right along with the whole idea of redistribution, that it's okay to take from someone who has, to give to someone who doesn't have as much, and without blinking an eye.
What's the retribution? She's not going to jail. There's no charges being filed, as far as I know.
She's admitting to voter fraud, and no one is investigating that.
I know.
It's just stunning.
In Ohio.
I wonder what would happen. You know, it begs the question, I wonder what would have happened had Romney supporters admitted to doing such a thing.
Well, you know, I mean, you heard reports. I mean, there were counties and precincts all over the country that registered only Obama votes, no votes for Romney at all.
Right, and that's mathematical. That's just impossible. That is not even believable. And what about in the counties like in Ohio, where they had 50% of the voters turn out? Excuse me. It's either 100% or less. You can't go above 100%.
Yeah.
And that's pretty stunning. And they're not even hiding it. They're not even attempting to hide it, and there is no retribution. But then King Obama is in his throne, and his Justice Department is under his thumb, and so there you have it.
We're in trouble, folks. We got big, big trouble. What a mess. What a mess.
It is a mess.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Bill Federer.
You live here?
Yes.
Well, maybe you know what a zombie is.
When a person dies and is buried, it seems there's certain voodoo priests who have the power to bring him back to life.
Horrible.
It's worse than horrible because a zombie has no will of his own. You see them sometimes walking around blindly with dead eyes, following orders, not knowing what they do, not caring.
You mean like Democrats?
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for details.
For peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
We're back. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is your Culture Vigilante Hour. Again, we're here every Wednesday evening, and tonight we are here with us once again, happy to have him, Mr. Bill Federer. We tried to have Bill on a couple of weeks ago, and through my technical inexpertise, I lost the communications with Bill. He so graciously agreed to come back on with us tonight. Bill's a historian, he's a great patriot, and he's an author, and he's here with us to talk to us tonight about his latest book. Bill, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hey, great to be with you, Lisa.
So you're a busy guy. You're just surfing around your web pages. I mean, you're not only you're an author, you have your own syndicated radio show. You write, you speak, you do all of these wonderful things. And I think I saw surfing around on your web page that you're planning a trip.
outright to Israel this coming October. And anybody's welcome to come with us. And the information's on the site. It's also going to have Frank Gaffney, who was on staff with Ronald Reagan, and he heads up the Center for Security Policy. And then also William Murray, Madeline Murray O'Hare's son. She's the atheist that got prayer out of schools. Well, he was the boy that she sued on behalf of. And since then, he became a Christian, and luckily in time, because after he had left working with his mom, she was kidnapped by some thugs and chopped up in pieces and buried in barrels in Texas.
Oh my God.
And anyway, had he still been working with her, he would have been included in those that were killed. But he has a ministry called Religious Freedom Foundation, and he is lobbying to get prayer back into our country and schools, and also he keeps in touch with the Christians that are persecuted in Muslim countries. And so he is a real insight into the fate of Christians that are in Palestine or in Syria, in Iraq, and heartbreaking stories.
Absolutely. So, and what inspired this trip to Israel?
Well, we've been several times before, and this will be a unique trip because not only will we see the historical sites, we'll also get to meet with the political leaders, the military leaders, go behind the lines that most tourists don't get a chance to go to. It'll just be a real insightful trip, and Israel's sort of the center of world politics, so you'll get an inside view of what's really going on right there on the ground.
Excellent. So you've got a new book out. You've got several books out, but now you have a new one out. And let's talk a little bit about your latest book.
There's a couple of them. We had just reprinted the American Minute book, and so there's one page per day of something that happened in American history, and that's originally done as a radio spot, and so I decided to turn it into a book as well. But every single day of the year, you get to read the story of something that happened on that day. You know, for example, today is the day that Alexander Solzhenitsyn was booted out of the Soviet Union, and he immigrated to America.
Well, I can't even imagine what kind of research, the amount of research that would go into doing something like that.
Well, it's just sort of been a passion. But yesterday's is interesting. That was the February 12th, 1809, is when Lincoln and Darwin were born on the exact same day.
Oh, really?
Can you believe that? And Lincoln is best known for what? Well, issuing the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing millions of slaves, and stating in his Gettysburg Address, 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Darwin's known for what? Well, the theory of evolution, which says all men are not only not created, they're not equal because some are more evolved than others. And in his book, Descent of Man, he talks about the inferior races, the savage, the weak, will be eliminated. He says the civilized races of men will exterminate the less civilized, and the break between man and his nearest ally will be wider, for it'll intervene between man and a more civilized state, as between a Caucasian and an ape, instead of as now between a Negro, Australian, or a gorilla, and whatever he meant by all that. But he definitely gave birth to what's called social Darwinism, and that influenced the founder of Planned Parenthood, Margaret Sanger. And she said that races of humans are more evolved than others. And so Margaret Sanger in 1922 wrote a book called Pivot of Civilization, where she advocating eliminating the human weeds that are overrunning the human garden. And she discipled a guy named Ernst Rudin, who was the German father of racial hygiene. Racial hygiene, what's that? Well, that's washing out all the inferior chromosomes from the human gene pool. And he went over to work for Hitler. and convinced Hitler that there was an Übermensch, a superman, an Aryan race, and an Untermensch, an undermankind, an inferior races, and he considered Jews in that category, and that gave birth to the horrible Holocaust. And so not only did Darwin influence Margaret Sanger, influence Ernst Rudin, influence Adolf Hitler, but Darwin influenced Stalin and Karl Marx, who both read his book. And Stalin was responsible for nearly 60 million deaths in the Soviet Union. And Darwin influenced Mao Zedong, who was responsible for an estimated 80 million deaths in the communist takeover of China. But Darwin, his theory of evolution has been used to undermine the belief in a creator God, whereas Lincoln's last act that he signed into law before he was shot was to put the phrase, "In God We Trust," on our national coins.
Hmm.
And so, gee, they were both born the same day.
The irony.
One's known for freeing the slaves, while the other's known for coming up with the doctrine that was used to enslave people, all right? And one's known for standing up for God, and the other's known for a theory that helps to undermine belief in God.
Oh, my gosh. The irony there is just amazing, and I can't even imagine the amount of research that goes into finding out these things and all that detail. It's just beautiful. A couple of weeks ago, I got a notice in my inbox about prayers and presidents inspiring faith from leaders of the past.
Right. Well, the current president decided not to celebrate the National Day of Prayer, which every previous president had, most recently since Eisenhower. And then all the presidents in the past had different days of prayer and so forth. So when the current president did not publicly celebrate the National Day of Prayer, of course, he did celebrate Ramadan, the Muslim
mm-hmm.
day of prayer, and he did celebrate the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered event in the White House, and he celebrated Cinco de Mayo in the White House, but he did not celebrate the National Day of Prayer in the White House. And so I decided to research all the past presidents and their proclamations of prayer. And I found some really interesting things. Now, not just does the book go back to the presidents, but during colonial times, every colony had days of prayer and, get this, days of fasting. And usually it was the concept was a relationship with God, and that when things were bad, you would have days of prayer. When things were real bad, you would have days of fasting and prayer. And when things turned around, you would have days of thanksgiving. So, for example, when there were 70 ships with 13,000 French troops headed to destroy Boston and then Philadelphia, and there was the governor of Massachusetts declared a day of fasting and prayer, and they prayed, and a hurricane wiped out the French fleet. The next year, 1747, Ben Franklin drafts a day of fasting and prayer, prints it in the Pennsylvania Gazette, and convinces the colonial legislature to pass it. And he also organizes the first volunteer militia in Pennsylvania. And that made him so popular that catapulted him into political arena and started his political career. But when the presidents have, Washington, for example, during the Revolutionary War, every year the Continental Congress declared days of prayer and days of fasting and prayer every year. And Washington ordered his troops to observe the days of fasting and prayer to Almighty God. And then we have... when they passed the First Amendment, the very week they passed the First Amendment is when George Washington declares a day of thanksgiving to Almighty God, thanking God for the Constitution's recently established. So the very First Amendment that they're using to kick out God, Washington had a day of thanksgiving to thank God for the First Amendment. And he said it was Congress that requested him to issue that. I put this all into the book, Prayers and Presidents, so I list them all in there. And I go through them, and my wife heard me talk so many times, she goes, "Well, what happened after they prayed?" And so we worked together on a book called Miracles in American History. So I go through and tell the whole story. So, for example, after the Revolution, Washington was the first president. John Adams was the second. And France went through a revolution. And rather than having what we did, a republic based on Judeo-Christian principles, they had a bloodbath. They chopped off 40,000 heads in Paris. 300,000 got killed in the Vendée, a religious Catholic area in northwest France. And it got so bloody that Napoleon finally took over as dictator. But during this time, the French broke all treaties with America and captured at least 300 ships and imprisoned our sailors. And they were demanding under the table bribes to leave our ships alone. And the cry went out across America, millions for defense, but not a cent for tribute. We weren't going to be paying off these people. And so John Adams is the president, and he asks Washington if he would put the uniform on again and be the commander of our army. And, and Washington says yes. This is the year before he died. And then John Adams has a day of fasting and prayer to Almighty God in 1798, then again in 1799. Luckily, the war was averted. The situation goes on with the Barbary Pirate Wars and the Muslims attacking our ships and the presidents having days of prayer. But then there's the War of 1812, and the British defeated Napoleon's navy at the Battle of Trafalgar. And so, with their navy being the undisputed leader of the world, the British now decide to take their navy and take back America, because Napoleon sort of stuck on the continent of Europe. And so they send troops to New Orleans, Lake Erie, and then Washington, D.C. Sort of interesting, the troops they send to Lake Erie, they captured Detroit, and they were taking back that territory. And a 28-year-old Oliver Hazard Perry gets some American ships together. They put them into the Lake Erie at Put-in Bay, Ohio. That's because they would put it in the bay there, Put-in Bay. And most of his sailors were freed blacks. And here he's fighting Robert Barclay, who fought Napoleon, a one-armed guy. And so these crack troops of the British with their ships with these long-range cannons. And they were blasting Oliver Hazard Perry's ship, the Lawrence, to pieces. And Hazard gets on another little rowboat, rows over to a second ship called the Niagara, and the wind changes directions. And so he sails right across the British line, firing away like a madman. And when he gets to the other side, the smoke clears. He had disabled the entire British squadron. He says to the men on deck, "The prayers of my wife have been answered." He writes to the Secretary of the Navy saying, you know, by the all-powerful dispensations of Providence, you know, we've been given this victory. And but never before had an entire British squadron been disabled and captured at one time, and that allowed us to recapture Detroit. Well, then the British sent 4,500 troops to Washington, D.C., under British Admiral George Cockburn, and the President, James Madison, has a day of prayer. And then another day of prayer, the British go into Washington, D.C., and Dolly Madison takes the portrait of George Washington off the mantle of the fireplace, and she's riding out of town on a carriage while he's riding into town. Well, he goes to the White House, goes inside, sees they were about to have dinner, and this Admiral George Cockburn sits down and eats the dinner and then torches the place. And then he goes to our Capitol building, has his soldiers sit in the seats where our congressmen are supposed to sit. He goes to the speaker's chair. He holds a mock Congress. And he said, "Who votes to burn the Capitol?" They all say, "Aye." And so they set fire to the place. Then they burn the Library of Congress, the Treasury, the Navy Yard. And then the skies darken and the winds pick up and slaps horse and rider to the ground, knocks off roofs and chimneys and you know, slates on the British soldiers, and picks up cannons, throws them yards away. And British Admiral George Cockburn exclaimed to some lady, "Great God, madame, is this the kind of weather you have in this infernal country?" And she said, "No, sir, this is a special interposition of Providence to drive our enemies from our city." And anyway, the lightning flashes, the British flee. Two of their ships were blown ashore, One British historian said more British soldiers were killed by the stroke of nature than by all the arms the Americans could muster in the feeble defense of their capital. Well, that was August 25th of 1814. After that is when James Madison declares a day of fasting and prayer to Almighty God. It's like, okay, God, you got our attention. Well, the British decide to attack Baltimore and Fort McHenry, and the storm system moves over Fort McHenry and dumps so much rain that when the British fired 1,800 cannonballs 25 hours with nonstop, most of the cannonballs sank in the mud because it was an earthen fort. And, of course, the next day, September 14th, is when Francis Scott Key saw the flag still waving and wrote the Star-Spangled Banner. And then you go to New Orleans. 10,000 British troops are marching toward Andrew Jackson. And he's got these ragtag, you know, soldiers and John Lafitte, the pirates. I mean, he's got this thrown-together group. They have a canal that's been sort of half filled in, but it's their wall, so to speak, and it's fog, and the British are marching and crawling up in the fog, and they capture one of the encampments that the Andrew Jackson had, but then all of a sudden the fog lifts, and the British are standing there like, duh, and the Americans are firing away at them. And the British officers get killed, and then the men don't know if they're supposed to attack or retreat, and they stand there in the middle just getting 2,000 of them get killed. And they finally surrender. Only 7 Americans got killed and 2,000 British. This was amazing. And then the British surrender, and then the rest of them leave. And before they could start some more problems, Napoleon escapes from the island of Elba. He had lost in Europe, and so they banished him to the island of Elba. Well, he escapes for 100 days and gets the Battle of Waterloo and 100,000, you know, troops. And so all the British troops have to be recalled from America to fight Napoleon. And they do defeat Napoleon, but this was calling them off our backs. Again, this is when James Madison has a day of thanksgiving to Almighty God. And but these are stories in our past when our country was facing unbelievable. I mean, the British Empire was the most powerful empire that planet Earth had ever seen. 13 million square miles, 500 million people. They controlled all of India, which is a quarter of the world right there. You know, countries in Africa and Hong Kong. And if it wasn't for the French and the Dutch giving them problems, they'd have focused all their attention on America, and we would have been recaptured. So a whole lot of just providential coincidences that just happen to have days of prayer and thanksgiving and fasting thrown in there.
Bill Federer,
but the title of that book's called Miracles in American History.
If I would have had someone like you as a history teacher when I was in school, I would have done a lot better in history. It's just fascinating to listen to you. Were you just always fascinated with this kind of thing as a child?
Well, my dad is a historian and attorney, and he was the head of several historical societies, the Carondelet Historical Society, the Chatillon de Menil Mansion down there by the brewery. You know, he was in charge of that several years, and that's sort of where I got the love for history. And
well, you can hear it in your voice when you speak how much you love it and how interested you are in the total depth and the detail and how it comes to life when you speak. It's just fascinating to listen to you speak about it.
Well, it's I wrote one book. It's called Change to Chains, and it's a 6,000-year quest for global control. And so I researched every civilization that has ever existed on planet Earth. Right, you know, 33 major Egyptian dynasties over 2,000 years, 18 major Chinese dynasties over 5,000 years, the Maharajas in India and Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar and Genghis Khan that killed 30 million people from Korea to Hungary. And you see that for most of world history, the most common form of government is dictators, monarchs, power gravitating into the hands of one person. And if you're friends with this person, you're more equal. If you're not friends with this person, you're less equal. And if you're an enemy of this person, you're dead. It's called treason. And so what was really rare in history is people experimenting in doing something different. And the first country to do that was Israel. When they came out of Egypt for 200 years, they did not have a king. They were ruled by the law, and everybody was equal before the law. But after 200 years, they said, we don't like this. We want to be like all the other countries. We want a king. And then there's Athens. A guy named Solon, S-O-L-O-N, about 600 B.C., invents this thing called democracy and says, okay, everybody in town's going to rule the town, the city of Athens, and he leaves, sets it up, and then he leaves. So they have to do this thing. And it works for a couple hundred years until Alexander the Great's dad conquers them, Philip of Macedon. And then Rome was a republic. SBQR, Senatus Publicus Romanus, until Julius Caesar makes himself dictator for life. And you go through all these attempts. There are very few. There was the Novgorod, a city in Russia on the North Sea, and they would all gather in their town square and shout for their leader, and whoever got the loudest shout was elected. But then Ivan the Fourth of Moscow killed 30,000 of them, incorporated Novgorod into the Russian Empire, and it was gone. And then Iceland for a couple hundred years, about 900 to 1200 A.D., they had all sort of judges and different tribes, but they didn't have a king, and it was sort of their experiment, and it worked until the king of Denmark conquered them. And then there was Holland. They had seven United Netherlands, and they did not have a king, and they invented the Amsterdam Stock Exchange. By the way, that was during Catholic Europe, charging interest and paying interest was a sin of usury. But when the Europe became Protestant, the Dutch came up with this idea that you could loan money to a quote-unquote corporation, and they could sail ships over to Indonesia, and when it came back, they would pay you interest on the profit. And so this birthed this stock exchange, and the Dutch became one of the most powerful empires in the world without a king. And they settled a New Amsterdam. And in America, it was a Dutch colony, and they had a New Amsterdam Stock Exchange that met along a street where they had a wall. But then the British took over New Amsterdam and turned it into New York, and it turned into the New York Stock Exchange or Wall Street.
Wall Street.
And that's a remnant of the Dutch Republic, a way of doing endeavors and businesses without taxes and without a king, and rich people doing it. People could invest. But anyway, America. And America is the most profitable and prosperous experiment of an alternative to a king. We took the power of King George III, separated it into three branches, separated federal and state level, and then tied up this new federal Frankenstein with 10 handcuffs. I use the illustration of the Terminator, with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and there's this assassin from the future that comes to kill him, and this guy gets blown into a thousand little metal pieces, and you sigh of a relief, like, oh, we finally killed the bad guy. And then the little metal pieces melt into little metal balls, and then they begin to roll together into little metal pools, and then it rolls all back together into one big metal pool, and out of it comes the Terminator again. And you're like, how do you get rid of this guy? Well, that's the way power was, right? Yeah. And the Tower of Babel, Nimrod, he had all the power, and God came down and confused their languages and scattered them all around the world. Right, but ever since then, there's been this unconscious desire for power to reconcentrate, sort of like the Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And so, I believe it's the sinful human nature that Cain killed Abel, and one king taking a kingdom from another king, and he puts some babies in a crib, one of them take the rattle from the other. But
politics is more a lesson in sociology than it is in political science.
Yeah, that's the one underlying premise that you get when you read through all of these governments and philosophers, is that the one common thread is that man is selfish.
Mm-hmm.
Mankind is selfish.
And it only takes a couple of hundred years to ruin a good thing, and we're right about there.
Yeah, I tell people it can take a lifetime to build a mansion and one irresponsible match to burn the thing down in a day. And we have inherited the biggest, the most beautiful mansion. We have more individual freedom and liberty, more opportunity, more prosperity, more religious freedom than any other generation, any other people, any other you know, civilization on this planet and all of recorded human history. And it's slipping through our fingers like sand.
Absolutely.
We don't know where we came from, and we're letting it happen. And
right.
So, anyway, that's why I appreciate you and your program to educate people. And so I try to write books. And AmericanMinute.com, you know, the little email I send out every day that gets a little bit of history.
Yep. I am convinced the way to get back onto the path of freedom is through knowledge and the knowledge of the history that we are throwing away, folks. And there's no better resource to get it at than AmericanMinute.com and Bill Federer. Bill Federer, thanks you very much for coming on again. And I'm so sorry about the mix-up before. And thanks for being gracious enough to come back. And we hope you'll come back again soon.
Anytime, Lisa.
Thank you so much. Bill Federer, AmericanMinute.com. Go there, buy one or several of his books, and sign up for the American Minute, and educate yourself and others about the reality of what this republic is all about and the history that made it so. Thank you, Bill Federer.
Thank you, Lisa.
Have a good evening.
You too.
We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with Tom Martz, and he's going to tell me why I'm overlooking this Yankee Doodle legislation thing with right to work. No matter what time of year it is, it's never too early to start preparing for the holidays. And here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, we're thinking of Christmas now. Why? Because we've set an ambitious goal for ourselves to raise $2,000. That's right, we want to raise $2,000 in 2013 to help some Missouri families who may be struggling in this Obama economy to provide a magical Christmas morning for their children. Last year, in 2012, Missouri Grassroots Coalition touched the lives of 15 families because of the generosity of conservatives across the state who provided us with the means to pay off their layaway accounts on Christmas Eve. This year, we'd like to be able to help twice that number of families, and we're asking you to help us with that goal. Please go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and click on the Secret Santa tab. All the details are there for you to send us what you can by PayPal, check, or money order. We want to thank all who contributed last year for their generosity and hope that you will all help us continue to prove that charitable giving works best in a constitutional republic.
And the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
We're back. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Culture Vigilante Hour on Missouri Grassroots Radio. We're here with Cindy McGee, who's sitting in with us tonight, and now we have also from the Locke & Smith Foundation, Tom Martz is with us, and he is here to help us. We've been doing this segment since Missouri Grassroots Radio was conceived. I have a real burr under my saddle about Yankee Doodle legislation, folks, and if you're new to the program, let's just kind of redefine what Yankee Doodle legislation is. Cindy and I, at the top of the show, were having a discussion about the way things are spun out of Jefferson City and the way it's been going on since before the Tea Party movement, but really has blossomed since the Tea Party movement. Legislators like to file a lot of legislation, and typically in a Missouri legislative session, more than 2,000 bills get filed throughout between December and May. And most of those bills do absolutely nothing to enhance your freedom or to secure your freedoms. And a lot of them do is get folks fired up because legislators have learned to speak conservative speak, constitutional speak, Tea Party speak. And they write legislation, and they go out and they campaign on this legislation, and it gets folks lathered up, all crazy, you know, hot and bothered under the collar, gets their support, makes heroes out of these legislators and these elected folks, because we think that they're actually trying to do something for us. And at the end of the day, if this legislation passes, it really does absolutely nothing except get them elected. It doesn't help you in one shape or another. So we have kind of created a segment here on Culture Vigilante, and we call it Yankee Doodle Legislation Alerts. And we have several updates throughout the session. Tom Martz from the Locke & Smith Foundation comes on. They review almost every piece of legislation that goes through the House and the Senate every session, and they pick out the most constitutional pieces of legislation, and they also flag and reward the legislators who champion those legislation, those pieces of legislation. Welcome, Tom Martz.
Good evening.
Let's just recap real quickly a little bit about what Locke and Smith is. You guys have been in existence for how long?
This will be the fourth year that we've been doing the legislative review. The organization has pretty much been in existence for about 5, maybe 6 years.
Okay, and so you've been awarded, you've been awarding legislators with the Locke and Smith Foundation Award for 4 years, and I was tongue-tied is what I am. I was very privileged to attend the last Locke and Smith banquet and watch the award ceremony there. And you guys just do an amazing amount of work every year sifting through all that legislation, and this year is no different. There's a lot of stuff flying through Jefferson City.
We have a host of volunteers. These people are individuals who would like to see this country get back to its constitutional roots. And what we do is we review every single piece of legislation that reaches what is considered the stage third read and passed, because that is where it can have an impact on the people of Missouri. We read the legislation. We get out both constitutions, depending on which one the bill is relating to, and we determine where within that constitution does the state legislature get the authority to do whatever it is. And if we cannot find the constitutional authority for it, we will consider that bill an unconstitutional piece of legislation. If you voted yes on it, you don't score any points. If you voted no on it, which is the constitutional vote, you'll score a point. Now, if the bill is constitutional, then if you voted yes, you score a point. If you voted no, you don't score anything. And at the end of the year, we tabulate up every single bill. Last year, we looked at 312 pieces of legislation, which ended up being 298 total votes in the House and 175 total votes in the Senate. And we ended up at the end, we ended up with Nick Marshall repeating the most constitutionally voting member of the Missouri House. And then also in the Senate was Will Krause. And they're awarded a, I'm going to say it probably weighs about 28 pounds. It's a 16-inch by 14-inch by an inch and a quarter thick solid piece of granite that's engraved with the state of Missouri. The year that they won it, the Locke and Smith Awards in the middle, and then their names down at the bottom.
And it's Missouri granite.
It is Missouri granite in most instances.
Yep. Okay. So, Tom, before we get into the heated debate on right to work, what have you got for us?
Well, we looked at tax credits, Senate Bill 10 and I think it was Senate Bill 87.
Is there ever going to be a good reason to have tax credits? I mean, I'm really not a tax credit person. I know that people just love it. I don't think you can ever really have a good tax credit.
I don't think you can either, but when you get to the point where they are now, where they're targeted, they're for certain organizations, they're for certain people. The Senate Bill 10, if you are married to a police officer, married to a firefighter, and if you have less than 5 acres of property and you're now a single woman, you get some homestead exemption. And it's just riddled with these things that, and I hate to say it in this way, but it allows the legislator to go back to his district, pat himself on the back, and have those who wanted that pat them on the back and say, look what I did for you.
Mm-hmm.
This is how I can benefit you through the legislative process. Just lower taxes across the board.
Yeah, with your tax dollars. And not that you don't want to help widows, but, I mean, since 9/11, I mean, we have lionized first responders. Not that they don't do a fabulous job and they don't deserve the credit that they get, but this creates a privileged class.
Absolutely, it does.
With my tax money. And people just, how do you say no to that? I mean, if you say no to that, that just makes you a horrible human being.
And some people might say, well, why is that bad? Well, if they break out their Missouri Constitution, Article 1, Section 1 states the following, that all political power is invested in and derived from the people, that all government of right originates from the people, It is founded upon their will only and is instituted solely for the good of the whole, not the whole of widows who were married to firefighters,
mm-hmm.
but the whole of everyone who was in the state of Missouri.
Yep. So, you know, just once, I mean, and I'm kind of going down a path here that's probably not relevant, but, you know, just once, I would really love to see somebody come in from Jefferson City or Washington, D.C. and say, you know, hey, we are not going to create more entitlement programs with your tax dollars. What we're going to do is we're going to encourage you, the private citizen, to pour money into your own community so that you can take care of these folks in your own communities the way you see fit. I would
Absolutely.
Just love to see that just once. You know, and
well,
if I recall, I mean, this may be kind of fuzzy. It's been quite a while, but the first time Bush 43 ran, he ran on those kinds of premises, didn't he, a little bit? There was that kind of that faith-based initiatives and things like that to kind of ease the entitlement situation?
Yeah, but the faith-based initiatives of George Bush actually took federal dollars and funneled it into the church, and then the church is a scream of bloody murder. But wait, you can't tell us how to spend it.
Yeah.
Well, if you're going to take it, you have to take it with the carrot.
Right. Okay.
You don't get to get it without the carrot.
Yep. Anytime you get government money, whether it's state or federal, it comes with strings attached, and that's not good.
Absolutely.
Okay, what are some of these other tax credits that we've got flying around here?
There are the different, the 501c3 not-for-profits. These are all the organizations that through the process of time has gotten the legislature to put a checkoff box on the W-2, or not the W-2, but the tax form that you fill out for the state of Missouri. It allows you through your tax refund to donate money to these organizations. So basically, you're paying the treasurer of the state of Missouri to handle these different funds and these different accounts set up for these organizations. They're a paid middleman, basically.
So we are giving a charitable contribution to the state government to redistribute to a charity.
Yes.
Instead of just sending it straight to the charity.
Yes. It makes it easy on people. I guess the thinking is that, well, if we make it easier on them, they'll donate more.
So the government looks compassionate and interested in the issues. And oh, okay, my head's gonna explode.
Can I interject something here?
Sure,
Lisa. This is Cindy. You know what occurs to me listening to you talking, both of you, is that this type of legislation has one specific purpose in the halls of the legislature, and that's re-election votes back home.
Yeah, Yankee Doodle.
How dare you think that way?
I know. I'm such a revolutionary.
You callous, hard-hearted Republican, you terrible person.
I don't care about widows. I don't care about orphans. I'm just a terrible person.
Well, right.
Or
how do you protest that? Yeah. Well, yeah. We're not getting into that, I hope, this year with the pet things. But, I mean, how do you combat that? How do you go and write a letter to your legislator or show up in the halls of Jefferson City and tell them, you know, knock it off? That's kind of stuff is just not going to fly. You know, that's exactly how they'll use the Alinsky tactics on you and tell you that you are a hard-hearted, terrible Republican.
Yeah, now keep in mind, for most people thinking about this, if you are on the Republican side of the aisle, and we don't look at whether they're Republicans or Democrats, but the simple fact that the Republicans right now have a supermajority, 99% of the pieces of legislation that are going to be read, passed, and make it to the governor's desk this year are going to be all Republican. So these are your representatives who have come to you and said, I'm a conservative, I'm fiscally responsible, please elect me, and then they go and do this.
Well, that's kind of typical. I mean, there is really, you know, very, very few fiscally responsible Republicans anymore. There's not much of a difference, and I think most people have kind of figured that one out. Okay, so is that it for the tax credit issue?
Oh, yeah, let's go to the one that's going to get me in deep trouble.
Okay, so just to lay the groundwork here, I've been a proponent of the right to work issue, and I understand that there are issues with this right to work situation with language and stuff. And I was not there. There is one bill floating around out in Jefferson City I haven't been able to find that seems to kind of appease the wording of right to work. I think from the libertarian conservative movement, right to work kind of bothers that movement because the legislation does not put the power back with the employer. It gives most of the power back to the employee to determine, you know, whether they are union or not. But if an employer wants to be a union shop and you pass right to work, they can't do that. Am I going down the right road with that, Tom?
Well, you are. If you're an individual who believes in property rights, the business owner owns the business, therefore that's his property.
Mm-hmm.
And what right to work is going to do, and this is not the basis of my discussion this evening, but what right to work will do, based on the way it is worded, it will give 100% of that authority over to the employee to determine whether or not he's going to comply with the business owner's demands. If the business owner says, you can come and work for me, you can come and lay my brick, but you have to join the bricklayers union. The employee can say, absolutely, I will not join the bricklayers union. You can fire me, I'll sue you, basically.
Okay. So,
who owns the job? The business owner does. That at first, that was my issue with right to work.
Okay, yeah, and
now I have the second issue.
Okay, let's have it.
Do you believe the Constitution is the law of the land?
Yes, I do.
Do you believe the Constitution is the law of the land in the state of Missouri?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
The federal or the state? Which Constitution are you talking about?
Both.
Yes.
Okay. Nowhere in the federal Constitution does the federal government have any right to regulate labor, business owner, employee relationships, correct?
Well, this is a state issue that I thought.
It is.
States are okay, and I sent you an email earlier with Rand Paul. We got to talk about Rand Paul. But, yeah, I mean, this is a state issue. The states are adopting right to work state by state.
Okay, but here's the problem with right to work. Right to work is a state statute.
Mm-hmm.
It can be eliminated next year.
Okay.
Article 1, Section 29 of the Constitution of the State of Missouri does hereby say that employees shall have the right to organize and to bargain collectively through representations of their own choosing.
Okay. So really, we already have right to work.
You already have right to work contained in the Constitution. Let's see some state representatives man up and say, we're going to go back to the Constitution of the state of Missouri. We are going to throw out every single piece of legislation that has been ramrodded through the federal level and anything that was done on the state level, and we are going to go back and comply, not with a state statute, we are going to go back and comply with Article 1, Section 29 of the Missouri Constitution.
Okay, I can go with that.
So, Tom, can I ask a question?
Yes.
I'm sorry. If this is really interesting. So, under that Missouri statute, or that's actually in our Constitution.
This is the Constitutional.
So that's part of our Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So, basically what you're saying is it allows employees to organize and to join a union, but that doesn't make that binding on all employees.
Actually, it
particular business.
Well,
does it say shall or may?
It says that employees shall have the right to organize and to bargain collectively through representatives of their own choosing. So in reality, even according to the Missouri Constitution, the employees have the authority, not the business owner,
mm-hmm.
but the employees do.
Mm-hmm.
So let's follow the Constitution. Let's stop making state statutes when in reality we don't need a state statute.
So if they have the authority to organize, they've already got right to work. So you can organize, or you don't have to. It doesn't mandate that you do it.
Correct. So why aren't we abiding by the Constitution? Why are we abiding by the Wagner Act, which is a piece of federal legislation that was handed down back in the 30s, when the federal government has no authority within the labor market, and we have the 10th Amendment?
Mm-hmm.
My whole argument is constitutional on right to work.
Okay.
We don't need a state statute.
You make a good argument.
As soon as you have a state statute that says you can, guess what? There can be a state statute that says you can't. We have a constitutional amendment on the Bill of Rights that says you can and you shall. That can't be overridden unless it is done by a vote of the people. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
So let's get back to the document in hand. Let's get back to the constitutional bounds of right to work. Get rid of this state statute stuff.
Okay. Well, okay, interesting. Okay, so HB 77 and 91. I came out pretty hard against both of these bills because both of these bills put this issue on the ballot. And, instead of putting this issue before the maintaining this in the legislature where I thought originally that it needed to be, because we sent those folks to Jefferson City to manage that situation and not to kick it back to the folks every time they didn't want to, every time they got into a sticky situation. But basically, since we already have it in our Constitution, what they need to do is repeal legislation.
Correct.
They need to go back, and they need to be repealing all of this bogus legislation that they've enacted over the years anyway.
Now, what they're going to tell you is that one of those two bills or the Senate bills do exactly that, when in reality it does not.
Okay,
only thing you're doing is you're overriding what is existing. At a later date, someone else comes along and can override what you just did.
So basically they're trying to use the state's to get a state statute passed to override what is in our Constitution, and statute really can't override the Constitution, or it shouldn't.
It shouldn't. And
so
trying
if they
to do
wanted,
is
if they really wanted to change this or make it effective, then if you want to pass the right to work, okay, let's just use that, just put it there, then that would need to be done as an amendment to the Constitution, which would then supplant what was already in there. Correct.
Yeah, but the problem is, but right to work as they want it is there.
Is in there.
Let's just use it.
They've already got it.
Quit playing ring around the rosy and just say, look, we are not going to abide by, and just start listing off every single act that has ever been passed that requires union membership within the state. Now, you can't do it in the federal employees.
No.
But you can do it with the state employees.
Why can't you do it with the federal employees?
Because they come under a different they come under the federal government auspices, not the state government auspices.
Oh, okay. So basically what they need to do is just go back into the statutes and clean up the mess that they've created for themselves, which they never do. They never repeal legislation.
Right. All state statute does is it keeps adding on layer after layer after layer after layer of stuff that eventually, and this is why judges have such an easy time of manipulating the language from the bench, because they keep piling statute on top of statute on top of statute on top of statute, and someone can easily say, well, precedent was set from 1940 to 2011, therefore this statute is unconstitutional.
Interesting. Interesting. So why hasn't anybody ever argued that fact? I'm sure there have been cases. Why hasn't anybody ever argued the constitutionality of the Missouri State Constitution?
I don't know if, well, on Missouri, I don't know. As for other states, I don't know if other states have the constitutional right to collective bargaining like is in our Constitution.
Huh.
But I don't understand why we try to take the easy road. Let's take the hard road for once go back to the Constitution. We are abiding by the document that was passed by the people, because right to work is clearly contained in Article 1, Section 29, and it is done in the same manner that right to work. The employees decide whether or not they're going to organize. And should a bunch of employees get together and decide they're going to organize, they can't hold everybody to it, because it clearly states, and to bargain collectively through representatives of their own choosing. So if you go to work at a place that's union, you can say, no, I'm not joining the union.
Wow.
It's all there. It's all there already.
I mean, I hate when I get into this argument, because everyone tries to say that I'm opposed to right to work. No, I'm opposed to the statute right to work.
Mm-hmm.
I want us to get back to the founding document for the state of Missouri. Quit trying to make this harder than what it is. Or go the route less traveled. Go the route of the Constitution. Get away from these state statutes. Because if they grant you a right through state statute, they can take it away through state statute. They can't take a right away in the Constitution unless we the people take it away from ourselves. And I don't ever remember voting in the 11 years that I've lived here to eliminate Article 1, Section 29 of the Missouri Constitution.
Hmm.
Have you?
No, I thought I was going to really argue this point with you tonight, but I don't think I am. I think I agree with you.
Well, what we support is already there.
Yes, what we support is already there, and no matter how many times I try to tell people that, I always get hammered. Oh, you're just a union sympathizer. You just this, this, that, to that. No,
no, because it does not support the unions. It doesn't support the unions. It supports the individual.
It does. And it's constitutional. It's in our Bill of Rights.
Wow. And so, Tom, help me out here. So that means that they've used state statutes to empower unions and various organizations in ways that are unconstitutional in Missouri.
Exactly. That is
and
the
so
whole
And so they need to go back and they need to
rescind
all. We need to have a state legislative session where all our legislators do is look at the garbage that they've passed over the years and strike it down.
Yep.
Just strike it out.
Yeah, they need to have a session in and a session out.
Yep.
At the beginning of the year, I actually asked a few representatives and a few senators to sponsor a piece of legislation for me. Or a rule, and that rule was going to be that the bill that they are voting on must be read in its entirety on the floor before it is voted on, along with the section of the Constitution that gives them the authority to do whatever it is that is stated in that bill.
Oh, you know what would happen? Because right about, April 25th or so, they would run out of time, because isn't that about when they start to put those omnibus bills together?
Yeah, but see, no bills are read on the floor. What they do is they read the bill number and they read the title of the bill. That's considered first
read. Yeah.
I was amazed when we had our day at the Capitol a couple weeks ago, and I got to meet with the gentleman who heads up the Legislative Research Committee for the House. And I asked him on certain instances, I said, look, if I in the Constitution and I can see that the what it is they're asking for is plainly not constitutional, how can you guys write that stuff? Lisa, he looked me dead in the eye and says, Tom, we have to write it. Now, what we will do is we will tell them that you will have constitutional challenges, and this is where it's going to come from. The common answer is that's not for you to decide. That's for the judges to determine.
Yeah, they throw it back to the courts, which is the last place you want to put anything. Because
now, if I'm a
legislator,
and these individuals who have been doing this for 20-plus years tell me you're going to have constitutional challenges in this section right here, I'm either going to say, okay, is there a way that we can reword this so
yeah.
I'm not going to have constitutional challenges, or can we just get rid of the nation?
Right.
And
for
if not, let's just
fight
the whole bill.
Right. For as hard as they fight to get stuff passed, why do they put substandard language, you know, in bills when they know it's not going to work?
Well, that's like House Bill 110. You know, that was one that we just looked at. They had an emergency clause vote on it. That was the one that was revolving around the Peter Kinder issue. House Bill 110, or actually the section in the Constitution says that the governor will appoint any vacancies unless otherwise provided by law. I read that thing 15 times, and I always thought provided said prohibited. So then I went to Section 105.030, and I said, okay, they're prohibiting the governor from appointing these certain positions. And one day I just happened to be sitting there, and I read it again, and it said provided for. And I went, whoa, wait a minute. That's not what 105.030 does. 105.030 does not provide any means by which these appointments are filled. It actually takes the authority away from the governor. So they violated the Constitution when they wrote 105.030, but nobody challenged it, so it became law.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, you've rendered us speechless, Tom. Not a good thing for radio.
They go up there and they just write this. Thank you. I love Yankee Doodle legislation. That's a great term for it. And they don't write it. Somebody else writes it for them. They don't vet it. They don't really consider the constitutional ramifications. And they just spend all of their time and our money shoving more garbage down our throats. And they're enabling, I'm going back to something you said earlier in the conversation, Tom, because I found this fascinating, and it suddenly hit me. They are enabling judicial activism by all
mm-hmm.
of the statutes and this bogus legislation.
Correct. And what we're working on now is we're working on a dollar figure on how much money does the average piece of legislation cost you. And I was talking to a former legislator the other day, and we were talking about all these things. You know, we got the state amphibian, we've got state jumping jacks, we've got the state this, we've got the state that. And this individual was telling me that they went through a two-hour debate on what the state mushroom was going to be on the floor of the House when that individual was in the state legislature. 2 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
Debating a state mushroom.
Oh.
That's 163 people.
Yeah. I would. How much do you know how much it costs just to hold a session between, you know, January and March, May?
Oh, we are honing in on those figures as we speak. I have an individual who's doing the research. I've got how much it costs for the House side and the Senate side. What we're looking for now is the building cost. But you're looking millions.
Oh, God, just makes me sick. Oh,
is that in the budget?
Yeah, that's in the budget.
Yeah.
Okay. I figured it was, but just thought I'd ask.
And a lot of people are unaware that about probably a little bit less than 2/3 of our budget comes from federal dollars.
Less than 2/3?
Yeah, a little bit less than 2/3.
Well, yeah, we would hope so.
Well,
I
would hope it'd be a whole lot less, but
with
that much money, you've got a whole bunch of carrots.
Right.
Yep.
And most of that's education money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And right now we've got the ramifications of all these different power plants are needing to comply with EPA standards, so there's even more dollars being funneled in.
Right.
Yep, Agenda 21. Holy cow. Okay, Tom March, you have rocked me back on my heels. I thought we were going to have a knockdown, drag-out, bloody-all fist fight here over Right to Work, but I don't think we are. I think I'm looking at this thing a whole lot differently than I was a few minutes ago.
Hey, we're on the same side.
Oh, that's right.
Just most people want it done through state statute. I want it done through what already exists, which is called the Constitution.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, we have a pretty thick constitution here in the state of Missouri. I mean, they've got pretty much everything covered. You know, we really don't need to be going and generating 2,000 bills per session every year.
Oh, it's pretty sad when you look at the Missouri State Constitution to realize that the last 9 or 11 pages is actually the U.S. Constitution. And every page in front of that, 400 and something, is all the Missouri Constitution.
Wow. That's,
actually,
yeah.
136.
And you know, Tom, in my opinion, when I look at our federal constitution, it pretty much gets the job done. Kind of begs the question, why did we need a state constitution that big? I mean, I understand the states have more powers to legislate than the federal government does, but I think we've really done a little overkill here.
Well, I think we've also lost sight of what the Constitution in reality is. Governments were instituted to defend the rights of the individual.
Correct.
And as long as you can write a piece of legislation or write a law, which, granted, it's not going to prohibit somebody from doing something against somebody, but it will give you the steps that you have to take to correct it.
Mm-hmm.
We've got so many different subcategories of subsets of this, of that. I mean, a couple of years ago, they were wanting to make it a crime to assault a sports official. Well, assault's already illegal.
Yeah.
because you're wearing a striped jersey, that was going to add more time onto your sentence.
Oh.
If you assault a police officer, well, if I assault a police officer, I get more time than if I were to assault you, Lisa, and you're a woman.
Excuse me.
I mean, it's just this thought process that we need to put people into these subcategories of categories gives us a revised Missouri statute that looks like the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, it's kind of like the whole tax credit thing. They're basically doing with that the same thing. They're selecting certain classes or individuals with certain associations or jobs or whatever, and they're giving them special privileges and exalting them above the average man walking on the street who might be assaulted.
Well, you know, if you go into any of your small businesses in your community, the ones that have been there for 20, 30 years, and start talking to them about how they started their business, I guarantee you they will not use the word tax credit. They will tell you that, no, I started this business. I went down and got a loan. I rented this building, or I built this building. And from there, I had to be a success. If not, my business would have closed down. Now, here in Springfield, we've given Walmart so many tax deferments, it's not even funny. And right now, everyone who goes and shops down on the south end of town at the new Sam's Club and the new Academy Sports Center down there, the extra taxes that are included in that facility, that's going to pay for that whole development in 20 years.
Wow. That's just amazing.
Wow.
That's your money, folks. There's your tax dollars. Hard at work.
I mean,
okay.
We're also getting ready to do a tax credit on sporting events.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Now, what absolutely blows me away is that cities like St. Louis and Kansas City, who the voters there just keep putting more taxes and more taxes and more taxes and more taxes on themselves. And these sporting events don't want to come there because of, one thing is the tax structure, the infrastructure, and everything else. So the state of Missouri says, well, we'll forego our portion of the taxes so you, St. Louis, and you, Kansas City, can host the NCAA tournament. You know, if the people of those areas weren't so stupid and kept taxing themselves, the sports authorities would go there because their tax rates are lower.
Right.
And it wouldn't cost so much to host and hold the events in these areas.
And there probably wouldn't be as much union authority, you know, driving up the costs to do so as well, because we already have right to work.
Do you know what portion of our workforce in Missouri is union?
It's very low, from what I understand. It's much lower than I mean, Missouri and St. Louis specifically used to be very union. And from what I understand, it's not as much so much anymore.
9%.
Yeah.
So 9%. Is holding the other 91% hostage? I don't think that's the problem.
Well, it's special interests and padding the coffers of campaigns. I think that's how that works.
Shh.
Okay, I won't tell anybody. Okay, thank you, Tom Martz. That's just you have changed my outlook on right to work. I'm shocked.
Good,
so
you
now,
can come to my aid the next time I'm being hammered on being a pro-union sympathizer. You can say, hey, wait a minute.
I will. And then it can beat up on both of us equally. Cause
yeah, that's right.
That's not going to be a real popular stance in the conservative community grassroots. I mean, the grassroots is pretty well convinced that we got to have right to work here, and I totally – they just don't know they've already got it. Okay.
No, I think what we have to do is take Tom's message to them.
If they're in defense of the Constitution
mm-hmm.
and they're not aware that it's in the Constitution, then they're not in defense of the Constitution because they haven't the slightest clue of what the Constitution says.
Yeah, they need to be educated. All right, Tom, we got a big job ahead of us. Thank you, Tom Martz. Go to lockandsmith.com.
That's it. Thank you, Lisa.
If you want to know more about Tom Martz and Lock and Smith and the great job they do here in the state of Missouri, they sure gave us an education tonight. Tom, we'll have you back in real soon.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. Talk to you soon.
All
okay,
right.
we're going to take another quick break, and Cindy and I are going to have a little discussion about some preparedness issues, and we'll talk to Ray Cuneo.
Have you joined Missouri Grassroots Coalition yet? The results of the 2012 election proved that the grassroots conservatives need to work harder to make their voices heard in government. The best way for Missouri conservatives to make their voices heard is to join together within the Missouri Grassroots Coalition Network and show our elected that we are a strong, unified, conservative voice in Missouri. Go to the website, MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, and click on the Join tab. Give us your contact information so that we can keep you updated on the latest developments in Jefferson City and beyond. Also, sign up for Grassfire Alerts so that you can get immediate notifications when we need to call grassroots conservatives together in action. Use the MGC network to help your grassroots organization speak with a louder voice, combined with grassroots groups across the state. Together, we can strengthen the conservative voice in Missouri.
Our well-being at home and our leadership abroad are inextricably linked. Our friends and allies must again be able to trust us. From Israel to Colombia, from Poland to the Philippines, our allies and friends have to know that we will be reliable and consistent and determined. And our foes can have no reason to doubt our resolve because peace really does come through strength.
Just when you thought it was all over, when you thought it was time to hang it all up, Lisa is back.
We're back. This is Lisa Payne-Nager, and you're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is your Culture Vigilante Hour. We're here every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. Big, long evening tonight. We had a great conversation with Bill Federer and Tom Martz of Lock and Smith Foundation just set me on my heels. What do you think about that, Cindy, with it already being in the Constitution? We're stupid.
Well,
we're fighting
we
for
are.
This.
And you know, Lisa, I was thinking about this on the break, and something hit me just square in between the eyes. And the fact is that it's pretty bad when our legislators are passing legislation without even knowing what's already in our Constitution.
Yeah,
that
I mean –
really
yeah.
scary.
But, yeah. That
says something really big about our legislators and the fact that they're not better versed and don't make themselves better versed to understand what's already in the Constitution. I mean, I'm stunned. I'm speechless
yeah.
to find out that right to work is already in the Missouri Constitution.
Yeah, that's going to hit like a bomb in the
But that's what we need. That's the word we need to get out because
yeah.
it doesn't have to be about opposing unions or codifying unions or anything else. The fact of the matter is that at some point in time, our Constitution was amended and right to work is already there. And why hasn't our state stood up and defended that?
Yep.
And supported it and made sure that it was followed.
I can't, yeah.
Instead, they've continued to pass statutes that one statute after another to try and override what's already there, either to help promote unions and get votes, or now we're going to try to take down the unions, or you know, or empower employees to not have to join a union. And it's just, it's insanity.
Yeah.
And
it
it's
is.
Already
it's,
there.
It's crazy. I mean, it's just, I'm just shocked. I'm just shocked that we've been fighting so hard for this, and we've been working so hard to get this word out, and we don't need to be doing this at all. I mean, we've already got
I've been a champion of right to work. I believe in that. I've lived in right to work states, and it's so much better.
Well, you know, here's the deal. Articles, not only does Article 1, Section 29 give already outline that we have right to work, Article 7, Sections 1 and 2 says that the Missouri House of Representatives has the responsibility to oversee the judiciary and impeach when they don't do their jobs. So this has been going on for God knows how long, and they have been working in contrary to the Constitution by ruling on these statutes, then they have not been doing their jobs.
No, they haven't. And it is time for our legislators to take their job seriously. And to, you know, Lisa, I don't even think they know what their job is anymore.
Well, you know, their job is to go to Jefferson City and get reelected by writing Yankee Doodle legislation.
Thank you.
That's pretty much what their job is.
It's about the power. It's about the money. It's about the power. It's about the money.
Yeah, exactly. It's become a monster. Yeah, I am too. I'm just speechless. Well, not necessarily speechless, literally, but I mean, I'm just shocked by it. So,
it is shocking.
We'll be contacting some folks tomorrow, kind of spreading that word.
You and
I were going to have a conversation tonight about some preparedness issues, because last week, you know, we had a show about Obamacare and, you know, what we project that it's going to do in this country once it takes effect in 2014, and it's going to be devastating to the economy. And there's a lot of conversation among the Patriot organizations about preparedness and what you can do to get prepared. We're not going to have time to do that tonight, so I'm hoping we can pick that up next week.
Okay.
Because right now we have an interview with Ray Cuneo that we've been talking to Ray off and on for the past several weeks, that he has been giving us a great education about what Agenda 21 looks like in our communities. And Ray helped me understand and outline what the East-West Gateway Council, and a non-governmental organization in the St. Louis area, does here to infiltrate my local and the local municipalities to bring Agenda 21 to the local areas. So let's take a listen to that interview right now.
This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio, and we have the pleasure once again to have with us Mr. Ray Cuneo. Ray's back with us to kind of give us an update on some things going on in Jefferson City and to kind of help define some things that have been happening on a local level. A few weeks ago, I was fortunate enough to attend a meeting conducted by the East-West Gateway Council here in the St. Louis area. And it's, you know, our local version of Agenda 21 right here in the St. Louis region. They have organizations like this all across the state, all across the country, helping smaller municipalities work together to bring Agenda 21 to your community. And Ray's going to help us define that. Thanks for being with us, Ray.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be back again. Thank you.
Okay, let's back up just a little bit, Ray. A couple of weeks ago, Lyle Rowland, who's been on the show before to talk about his bill HB 42, the Agenda 21 bill, it had a hearing on the 31st, I believe, it had a hearing on the 31st in the Committee for Tourism and Natural Resources. Big deal, a lot of people there. You were there to testify at that hearing and give those folks on the committee some education about what Agenda 21 is. And what did you learn when you were at the hearing?
Well, first of all, we had terrific attendance, both from a audience standpoint and those giving testimony, plus the fact of the committee itself. The committee members, it was like 23 committee members there, and they had reason they had to be there that day, whatever it was. But at any rate, as far as those in the audience, we probably had, well, the chairman had asked to, by a show of hands, how many people were there to testify in favor of Lyle Rowland's bill, and I would just guess probably 17 or 18 hands went up. He was asked how many was there to testify in opposition, and there was nobody at least there that acknowledged or wanted to testify in opposition. So there was really a good turnout. The room was pretty well packed. And the hearing itself, after all the introductions were made and everything by the committee, the hearing itself, once we got started with testimony, went for about an hour and a half. And there was a lot of good testimony, and there was a lot of questions. I would have to say most of the committee members seemed like, well, what the heck is this? Yeah, we've heard something about Agenda 21, but what's the big deal? We don't know a whole lot about it. That was the general sense that we got. It seemed like as we dug in through the testimony and they started hearing more about it, then there was more questions that came forward, primarily from those representatives from around the more urban areas. Primarily, I think there's three or four, maybe five, specifically from the St. Louis region. So there was a lot of questions there. I guess overall we certainly felt like with the variety of testimony we had, it was we did a good job of trying to educate them. But as you know, when you look into something like Agenda 21, to try to do in individual testimony or even in the aggregate of all the testimony, it's hard in a short time if you're talking to folks that have no idea what Agenda 21 is, to really give the overarching view of what it is. So, but it went well. It went well, and we're still waiting for that to come out of committee. We're in hopes that, if anybody out there is listening that has knows of members that are on the committee, please encourage them to, to try to educate themselves more if they don't know, and to vote the bill out. It's HB 42. So
absolutely.
And then, of course, we have now just last week, Senator Brian Nieves, he filed his bill. It's SB 265. SB 265. And it mirrors exactly the language that is in HB 42. So they're companion bills. They're now in play. There hasn't been a committee hearing yet on the Senate bill. We're in hopes that'll be coming up. We don't have a specific day yet, but we're in hopes it'll be probably the last week of this month.
Okay, very good. So it's very important. We would really like to see some movement on at least one of these bills. So HB 42 has already had its hearing. We needed to get out of committee and to get onto the House floor for debate. SB 265 just introduced into the Senate last week. Either one of these bills could go through both houses. If they're companion bills, the language is identical. We need one of them to get some movement. So contact your representatives. It's important to contact all of the representatives in the state to get them on board, to give them an education about this issue so that they can encourage movement in these committees. And there is a link up at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org with a listing of all of the email addresses for the House and the Senate. You can just copy and paste into your address line of your email and compose an email and shoot that right off to your representatives and let them know that this is an important issue to you, and hopefully to educate them a little bit too, because there's probably a lot of sitting elected in Jefferson City who don't really understand what Agenda 21 is and how it affects you. So if you have information to share, please send that on.
I might also mention that both the bills that we have here in Missouri that are in play are almost identical to the legislation that passed last year and is now statutory or law in Alabama. There's just a minor wording difference, but in essence, it's identical to the Alabama law. So, and one thing, and of course we mentioned this to some of our legislators up there, that the Alabama law passed through unanimously through all committee hearings and through both houses in the legislature down there. So maybe that will spur some interest for them to take a more serious look.
Very good, very good. Yeah, we could take a lesson from them. Okay,
sure.
let's talk a little bit about Agenda 21 and what it looks like on a local level. To you and me and all of our neighbors, you know, in our neighborhoods, because really that's where Agenda 21 is most effective in gaining its ground. It worms its way into the communities via these organizations. And in St. Louis, our organization is the East-West Gateway Council. And from what I understand, Ray, and I need you here to kind of direct me and give me a definition here, but from what it looks like that I have experienced, for, you know, just my limited experience with the East-West Gateway, is that these are non-governmental organizations that work with municipalities and help them formulate regulations and guidelines within their municipalities to bring in Agenda 21 agendas.
Well, you're correct that that's certainly the case, but you know, let's take a real in-depth look here at what regional government is. First of all, regional government, so everybody is clear on this, it is legal. It has statutory authority here in Missouri in the 1960s, and it's supposedly coordination of local governments in some of their activity, and it's all volunteer. But the regional government concept has really been hijacked by the federal government as a major tool or instrument in promoting sustainable development. Regional government, as I said, it is legal, but it is not a representative form of government. It's not a Republican representative form of government. It, in fact, it diminishes local authority, and it is driven administratively. So, in other words, pretty much the people are left out of the process. There's no elected official that is elected to sit there per se, even though there are representatives from the various counties and cities that do sit on the council. But it's very attractive for the federal government to come in with their sustainable community grant funding programs and to use the mechanisms or the structure of government to promote it. And, of course, even though this supposedly regional government and their dealings is all supposed to be all voluntary, the fact is when the federal government comes in with a grant planning process for the region, meaning land use activities, resource activities, transportation issues, et cetera, the federal government considers that to be a holistic idea, meaning it incorporates all the area, not just one political subdivision. And the federal government asks local government, or the East-West Gateway and their local consortium members to sign memorandums of agreement. And in the case of St. Louis right now, HUD has an agreement, U.S. Housing and Urban Development. Of course, EPA is involved and USDOT. But when you sign that, when local government or through East-West Gateway signs that memorandum of agreement, the federal government makes it perfectly clear it is considered a binding agreement. And I think in past segments we've talked about when you take federal grant money, and this is backed up by Supreme Court cases, that in essence they can regulate what they fund. So that's the whole motivation, and that is in a very effective way for the federal government to pour in millions of dollars into a geographical regional planning area to put forth their agenda for sustainable development, sustainable communities. Now, that's a quick overview of how it operates.
Okay, so in our case, in this meeting that I attended, and I'm pretty sure that my community has signed on to the whole deal here, because my county executive is the chairman of this committee right now for East West Gateway. I know that they've received almost $7 million for a project to implement sustainable development pieces throughout several adjoining counties in the St. Louis area, St. Louis region,
right.
I guess. And it's binding. It's like you said, it's binding. The federal government has kind of reached into our little municipalities and our counties and our little regional area, and we are now bound by this doctrine, this document, to implement Agenda 21 issues.
What you're referring to, Lisa, I think, is when all this federal funding came in, they call it community planning areas. Community planning
right.
areas. St. Charles County has one. St. Louis County,
and
Jefferson County.
Yeah, and a couple counties
Franklin
on the east
County,
side.
Franklin County is the only one that does not. And, of course, each of the cities that comprise the East-West Gateway region on the east side over in Illinois all have one, as well as St. Louis City. And of course, these projects are designed to be, and I just was looking at a document here earlier, they call these community planning areas, which, and I'm quoting here, which will be delineated on the basis of job clusters, transportation corridors, housing affordability, land use development patterns, and existing plans, and will cut across municipal boundaries. So right there, they tell you right there that, look, in essence, we don't, regardless of what the local political subdivision or municipalities or county feels about an issue, that if they sign on to this thing, that they're going to be part of the holistic regional planning concept as put forth by Housing and Urban Development, along in conjunction with USDOT and EPA.
So one thing that really raised a red flag for me when I sat in this meeting was we had the East-West Gateway Council, kind of giving their spiel and kind of giving us a plan and an overview of the kinds of things that they could implement in our county to kind of link smaller municipalities together within the county. They were providing wording for the municipality, the statutes that you can adopt within your municipality to kind of do all. They're writing legal language for county governments to adopt
and I don't know, you probably have, I don't know whether the ICLEI group or, well, I'm sure the American Planning Association is involved in all these counties. I know in Franklin County, where I'm a planning and zoning commissioner, I mean, the American Planning Association sends all of their literature and stuff on sustainable development, but there are a whole host of non-governmental organizations that deal directly with local governments to and provide software and modeling for local ordinances and laws to
right.
guide the sustainable development concept. So in essence, they are, if you're a member of one of these groups, or if local government is a member of one of these groups, you have firsthand availability to you of modeling concepts that will incorporate those sustainable development concepts. Now, if that's not enough, you certainly have the consulting industry. The consulting industry is playing a big, big role in this. Again, they're a non-governmental. Now, they may not per se be ICLEI or the American Planning Association, but you have various consulting groups here in the St. Louis area. Horner and Schifrin is a big one that deals with the bike trails and trail net and so on, and I don't mean to pick on them. There are many other ones. But what I find interesting here a couple of years ago, about a year and a half ago, I was at a meeting, a large meeting of East-West Gateway, and about a two-hour meeting on the whole concept of sustainable communities in the greater St. Louis area. You get a budget here of East-West Gateway's budget comparing 2011 to 2012. In 2011, federal grant money coming to East-West Gateway for these activities was $11.4 million. In 2012, it jumped to $21.2 million. Now, those are federal grants coming into East-West Gateway to promote this. What is interesting on the expense or expenditure side, in 2011, for public agencies and planning consultants, public agencies, that'd be public local agencies and planning consultants, the expenditure was $4.6 million. That jumped to $10.9 million in 2012. So you can see the significance of how the non-governmental groups, be it directly the American Planning Association or some of these consulting groups, are playing in this. And I can assure you that these consulting groups are totally indoctrinated and pushing the concepts of sustainable development / sustainable communities.
Yeah, so in effect, what we have is we have the government paying huge amounts of our tax dollars to consultants to come in and sell sustainable development policy, language and all, for your local, your little local municipality to develop and implement, you know, at the hands of, I mean, and this is all at the hands of the big government. It's they're coming in and the taxpayers' money is being used for these people to sell this to your local county council or your local city council to come in and take all of this money, and it's all binding. And what they're effectively doing, they're doing this in all of the municipalities and all of these surrounding counties in the St. Louis region, is they are weakening your individual municipal government and merging them with the surrounding municipal governments, and your little municipal government is just becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. They are bloating they're bloating small government into a big government.
Diluting local autonomy.
Yes.
Diluting the
beautifully said
representative government at the local level. In other words, it's bypassing the consent of the governed. It's strategically designed to do that by the federal government, and it's very effective. And by the way, as we've discussed in previous sessions, it's just not East-West Gateway here. You know, there are two other metropolitan regional planning governments in Missouri, plus 16 rural regional planning governments. And not only is it happening in Missouri, virtually every state in the United States has a regional-type government structure. So it is a very effective mechanism and all-encompassing for the federal government to come in to local governments that incorporate 70% of the land area, that's a rough number, 70% of the land area of the lower 48. The federal lands and issues surrounding those is a separate initiative.
So, I mean, it works much like any other governmental agency that accepts federal dollars to implement a program. Like, let's use, for example, the Department of Education. They accept federal funds to implement Race to the Top or Common Core Standards. They do it outside the purview of the legislature, so the voters and the elected folks have no control over that because they've accepted the government grants to implement these issues. So you are absolutely, the taxpayer is left out of the mix, left out of the authority to do so. And like you said, Ray, it's not only happening in St. Louis, it's happening all across Missouri and all across the United States in these very small community ways.
It is. It absolutely is. And, you know, this whole concept of sustainable development, our Agenda 21 Sustainable Development, better known here in the United States as Sustainable Development Smart Growth, Congress has been left out of the loop. It's designed to leave the legislatures out of the loop. It's designed to leave the autonomous, supposedly autonomous local government out of the loop. And it's been very, very meticulously designed to do that. And, of course, we're only talking about one way of doing this. There are a whole host of things. But this is very important because it covers such a large area all at one time. And the reason the federal government loves to operate this way, they come in and they say, well, look, it takes the legal jurisdictional monkey off their back, as I've said before, because they don't fear a challenge to their jurisdictional efforts, because they say very simply, local government through their representative at East West Gateway, our regional government, has signed a bonding contract with us. Therefore, it is a contract. It's not an issue of whether we have jurisdiction or whether the state has jurisdiction or local government has jurisdiction. It is a binding contract.
Okay, so folks, we have East West Gateway in the St. Louis region. There are other non-governmental organizations all across the state of Missouri. Find out what yours is. All across the country, find out what yours is and get involved at the local level. It's the easiest place for you to make a difference, right in your own backyard. Get involved. Call your county council. Call your city council. Find out when the meetings for these plans are taking place. They're going on all the time. Go to these meetings, get involved, voice your opinions, find out what they're saying, and help to put a stop to this, because this is the biggest constriction on your personal property rights that there is.
Absolutely. And you know, Lisa, it's very difficult when you talk to the legislature for them to see how they've been sidestepped in this process. They can't believe that the federal government has done an end run around them and in such a devious way. But it certainly happens, and that's part of the challenge. We have to educate our local officials. We have to educate our local our state legislators as to what is happening here, because we're going to lose our state sovereignty. We're going to lose our local autonomy if we do not. Representative form of government is out the window unless the people are the key here.
Right.
The people are the key. We cannot rely on the representatives to educate themselves. The people are going to have to become educated and demand that their representatives find out what's going on and take appropriate action.
Yep. Well, that's why we need bills like HB 42 and SB 265. So, again, folks, it's very important to be in contact with your representatives on a local and a state level to make sure that we can put a stop to these things. Ray Cuneo, thank you again so very much for your insight and your contribution to this situation. I hope you'll come back soon and keep us posted on the developments, on the things that are going on in Jeff City and anything else that may come along.
Be glad to do it. My pleasure.
Thanks.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you, Ray. I really appreciate it.
Okay, folks, that's going to about wrap it up for another session of Culture Vigilante on Missouri Grassroots Radio. We're going to be here again next week, Wednesday night, 7 o'clock Central Standard Time. We're going to have Will Estrada from parentalrights.org. We've got another interesting piece of legislation coming through Missouri. Representative Kurt Barr filed a piece of parental rights legislation, and we're going to get some clarification on that. And you know, there's some controversy on, is it strong enough legislation? Is it too broad? Is it too general? You just never know what you're going to come up with here in Missouri, because we're finding all kinds of things out about some legislation and maybe some companion pieces that might go along with it to help keep it strong and enable parental rights. Anyway, I want to thank Cindy McGee for being with us tonight, and we're going to have her back next week, and we'll talk a little preparedness that we had planned to do tonight that we didn't get to because we ran a little bit long. Thanks again to Bill Federer. Always love listening just to his mesmerizing recounts of great history. And Tom March, thank you, Tom March, for giving us that enlightening view of what right to work really is here in the state of Missouri. It looks like we're going to have a lot to do to take that piece of legislation and get the education out to the folks.
And Ray Cuneo, always, we want to thank him for his contribution to our education for on Agenda 21. Everybody, you know, folks, if you want to change your government, you actually need to get involved. You need to do something. It's one thing to sit around and educate yourself about it, but you got to take the next step and you got to do something about it. So that means casting a wider net than just around the Patriot bubble. We all live in a nice little Patriot bubble, and sometimes we like talking to ourselves, but you got to go next door to your neighbor who's busy taking their kids to soccer practice, or to your brother-in-law who's a little bit disengaged and not necessarily, you know, as involved in the issues. You got to cast a wider net if you want to change something. So that's what a culture vigilante is. Next week we'll be here again, 7 o'clock Central Standard Time. Thank you for being with us.
Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.